You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Heart of where innovation, money, and power collide in Silicon Valley and beyond. This is Bloomberg Technology with Caroline Hyde and Ed Ludlow.
I'm Caroline Hyde at Bloomberg's World Headquarters in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg Technology.
Coming up, Amazon CEO Andy Jassy. He says the generative AI boom is going to be built on Amazon Web Services. We'll bring you the takeaways from his annual letter to shareholders.
Plus, technology heavyweights descend on Washington for the White House state dinner, with big names like Jeff Bezos and Tim Cook attending a lavish event.
And OpenAI CEO Sam Altman pitches a global AI coalition on his visit to the Middle East. Next stop, maybe we see him over on Capitol Hill too. We'll discuss that and so much more throughout this hour. But Ed, we start on these markets. Up a quarter of a percentage point currently. NASDAQ managing to pull itself off of its lows. This is as we once again really tackle inflationary pressures, whether it's a PPI number coming after the CPI print yesterday, both showing inflationary pressures just start dialing up that little bit. And we're seeing, though, managing the NASDAQ to outperform as bond markets actually pull back a little bit. I'm looking at the two-year yield. We're outperforming on the front end of the curve, whereas the back end, the 10-year yield, for example, yield's still pushing higher. But really, the big move was yesterday. And looking at what's happening in the euro, it's not just all about the Federal Reserve. It's about global world banks at the moment, central banks, that is. And we're looking at what the ECB said. Look, staying pat, as many had anticipated in terms of interest rates, but signaling that inflationary pressures are dialing down across the Atlantic, and therefore could we see cuts coming? We're off by 0.3% versus the US dollar. Move it on, look at what else is performing versus the US dollar. Crypto, I'm down by 0.2% on Bitcoin at the moment, just sub that $70,000 level. But Ed, what are you watching on the micro?
There are a lot of stories to fit in today. Apple's a name that we're going to look at later in the program with Bloomberg's Mark Gurman. We're up 0.8%. Early unionization efforts are kind of the main headline. But there is a note from JP Morgan analysts that say that hedge funds are now looking at this stock and considering what happens next with artificial intelligence in the context of value add, iOS and the handset. Hard to know what the driver is, if any at all, but we're higher 0.8%. And given its market capitalization, we always pay attention to Apple because of its weighting on major indices. There is an annual shareholder letter plus AI theme into today's show. I am very excited about it. JP Morgan is down 0.9%. Monday night, I know I wasn't here earlier in the week, put the shareholder letter out and says AI. And we're going to talk about the numbers behind that. I think it's really interesting. So too Amazon, up 0.3%. Andy Jassy's annual letter. The focus about AI is interesting, specific to AWS. Amazon is going to be a facilitator, a place where AI is built by others, maybe not building so much generative AI themselves. That's a story you and I have told quite a lot in recent weeks and months.
We are long shareholder letters. Let's dig in with Poonam Goyal of Bloomberg Intelligence. And Ed just puts it so eloquently there. Ultimately, they want to be at the very heart, the infrastructure of generative AI. Yes, they will build a substantial number of Gen AI applications ourselves, but they're looking to others to build.
Yes, you're absolutely right. You know, right now, Amazon lags Microsoft when it comes to AI because Microsoft has access to the OpenAI. However, as they build these building blocks going forward, they can close that gap over time. So we think the investment is right. We think the time is right. And generative AI will not only help fuel the AWS business, but also its e-commerce marketplace business, where it will help drive sales higher.
Poonam, what we're talking about specifically is Bedrock, I think. And you can go to Bedrock if you're a very large enterprise player or a smaller startup and build your own large language model. You can take advantage of a third-party large language model. Caroline and I have spoken to Anthropic, for example, Daniela Amodei, and she talks about all the business they're winning through AWS Bedrock. What I don't know is Amazon's cloud business, AWS, actually gaining new customers, gaining growth or market share because of their strategy with Bedrock?
Yeah, I think, you know, over time they will gain new customers. It's just a matter of getting these large language models developed and them getting the customers interested. But we do think there's scope for Amazon to continue to gain in that vertical.
What's interesting is, well, Google's event earlier this week, cloud event, and they were really saying that it's startups that are coming to them for cloud. How much ultimately do companies diversify, not go all in with one player?
I think diversification will happen across the board. It depends on what you're using and where you want to be. Amazon has done a great job in attracting not just the startups, but also established businesses. So we think the scope is wide. We do think they're in the early innings of this. And we do think right now they lag, but that doesn't mean that they'll lag for a long time.
Let's talk about Andy Jassy. He comes from AWS. That was his world. But the story since he's taken the helm of Amazon has been about cost discipline. In fact, don't even call it discipline, Poonam. Let's call it what it is, cutting cost, lowering CapEx. And when I read the letter, he seems committed to that still.
Yes, he does. In fact, you know, they've been highlighting since last quarter about the 45-cent reduction that they've had per unit in their cost basis, and they think they can press the pedal harder on that this year, largely as they basically streamline their inbound fulfillment and they parse out packages more efficiently to those regional distribution centers that allow for same-day delivery.
Poonam Goyal of Bloomberg Intelligence, one of our analysts that leads coverage of this stock, and we're really grateful to have you in Reaction. Meanwhile, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos joined tech heavyweights last night at the White House state dinner hosted by President Biden for Japan's Prime Minister, Fumio Kishida. Attendees included Bezos' fiancée, Lauren Sanchez, Apple CEO Tim Cook, and executive Lisa Jackson. Microsoft's President Brad Smith was in attendance as well, and actor Robert De Niro, even venture capitalists, including Robert Stavis of Bessemer Venture Partners. You also had Jamie Dimon, Masa Sun, and John Gray of Blackstone. And Caro, for me, the story is pretty clear here. Japan important for technology and the economy.
And more broadly, for big get-togethers of some important players, no matter where they tend to be based. I mean, this is where some certain conversations are had, deals are done, how many are having intimate conversations with the Prime Minister of Japan. But more broadly, I liked his Star Trek reference as well. If you heard some of the commentary coming out of the leader of Japan, he was sort of going to go boldly where no one has been before in terms of deepening the U.S.-Japanese relationship. But this is more broad, isn't it, as well? I mean, there's a delightful menu that they managed to be having, dry-aged ribeye steak. Not bad. But this is also about deepening ties, but not just from an economic perspective. I'm going to think of this from a geopolitical perspective, and notably what's happening with the Philippines coming in at the moment, and indeed what this means for China-US relations.
Yeah, I go straight to China. When the CEOs turn up, you know that that market is important, right? Whether it's for supply chain or the economy. Director, let's bring that menu back up. That is contemporary, modern American Japanese fusion. That looks great. But there's also a political element to this as well, that Biden had a lot of big names in the White House in an election year, Caro.
Yeah, I think that is really notable. And ultimately trying to ensure that the economy is what Biden can hang his hat on as well. Many worrying about the inflationary pressures that were garnered yesterday and indeed what this really means for Bidenomics and the lack thereof. But tech heavyweight really clear and present when it comes to relationships with the US and Japan. JP Morgan. It kicks off earnings season. Banks, they are at the start of them. Happens tomorrow. And earlier this week, just remember, we heard from the CEO, Jamie Dimon, in his annual letter to shareholders, where he focused mainly on artificial intelligence. Joining us now to discuss how banks are utilizing the technology, investing in it, Evident CEO Alexandra Muzavizadeh is with us. Evident is an intelligence platform that really benchmarks, it tracks AI adoption across financial services sector. And JP Morgan is the standout performer, Alexandra. You think that's in some way akin to the performance of the bank and its stock more broadly?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me on, Caroline and Ed. But its performance is incredibly strong in terms of its AI maturity. It's head and shoulders above other banks. It was early to the game. Jamie Dimon made AI a focus for the bank 6 years ago, where he made clear that it was going to be an AI-first organization. And from that followed a lot of initiatives, like establishing a research lab, you know, doubling down on hiring AI talent, reorganizing the exec team. And that really has paid off. And you see, well, according sort of to our measurements, you can see that they sort of really stand out against other banks and are incredibly strong on AI capabilities.
We've been looking at the data behind JP Morgan's AI hiring. You just made a really interesting point, which is 6 years ago this all started. Let's show the chart. There's the AI hype of 2022, 2023. But if you track the hiring, and what's so interesting, the title of that chart is JP Morgan Slows AI Hiring. But look how elevated it was in 2022, and it started back in 2020. What do you make of that? About how ahead of the curve or not, so to speak, JP Morgan is.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, first of all, it's really important point that you make it in terms of the hype in 22 and 23 of AI, and sort of what we're heading into is more of a let's sort of see what gets through production. It's much harder than we think, and sort of the use cases going from ideation to production just takes a little longer. And some of that slowdown in hiring is also a little bit of a what talent do we actually need? But when you look at that chart, you can see that really being on a hiring tear for the last sort of 6-7 years, and you know the proportion of AI talent and the caliber of AI talent in the bank is second to none. So right now, a lot of the banks are looking at the onset of using generative AI. Where are we using it in the bank? Which platforms are we going to use, whether it's OpenAI or Mistral or Hugging Face, which one of those, how does it fit into our particular needs, and how do we refine it so it gives us the best output possible? So there is a bit of a, let's see what we can use internally of our AI talent that can help us, refine that and before we sort of accelerate again and think about what we hire externally. But it should also be noted that when you sort of look across the banking sector, even the banks that have cut employees have sort of tried to keep the AI talent sort of relatively steady, if not increasing.
Talking of talent, of course, within that shareholder letter was the demonstration of their commitment to elevating almost to executive level the discussion around AI. And they mention the importance in creating that new position, Chief Data and Analytics Officer, that sits in the operating committee. That person over at JP Morgan is indeed Teresa Heitensretter, who I was lucky enough to speak to at an Evident event. And it's notable that she has been galvanizing the focus on sort of from top down, ensuring that all talent are in line with where AI can really bring about a change in productivity. Where are they seeing a drive down in costs? Where are they passing this on to the user of JP Morgan?
Yeah, when it comes to, when it comes to driving the use of AI, and where you sort of look at the letter is really talking about gaining efficiencies and really making the bank sort of strong and lean and robust for withstanding sort of any macro challenges in the future. So looking at driving down the costs and bringing up efficiency and bringing up productivity and AI being used to also see where you can elevate revenues is where is that it's sort of in every nook and cranny of the bank, looking at sort of the ways that it can create that return on investment. And then, you know, with the AI tools, that then gets passed on to the customer and, you know, in better customer management, you know, experiences, if time and, yes. And products too.
Alexandra, do you think Jamie Dimon has a good understanding of artificial intelligence, he himself?
He is, Nick. He saw it very early. He knew it was going to be very impactful. He was one of the first CEOs, bank CEOs, to go out and say, we are changing. We are going to be an AI company or an AI-first company, where many banks would be, we're going to be great banks and using AI to become a little bit yes. better bank. He was a visionary with that. I think he has a good understanding, yes.
He's more upbeat about it than he is about Bitcoin. Alexandra Moussa-Vizadeh, yes. It's great to have you, of Evident, of course. Now, EU's top tech regulator, Margrethe Vestager, says AI could be as disruptive as the atomic bomb. The Executive Vice President of the European Commission joined Bloomberg earlier today to talk about the current state of AI.
It's top of mind for us to make sure that the market stays competitive when everything gets fueled by artificial intelligence. It's going to change the marketplace.
Do you have a timeline at all, Commissioner, when we could potentially see some movement on this?
No, we don't have a fixed timeline. Of course, we want to produce results as fast as possible, also for the involved companies, for their benefit. We'll be getting there soon, I think.
So we're talking about Microsoft and OpenAI, but of course they're not the only players here. You have Amazon actually with a big, almost $3 billion investment into Anthropic, which of course competes with OpenAI. What do you make of that? Is that something that you're looking at as well?
Well, we will be having, you know, a vigilant, keen attention to what is happening in this field. We see a lot of entrenched market power when it comes to technology, and it's really important that now when we have technology, which is not just a new technology, it's basically a new world that we're looking into, that we make sure that it's a competitive new world.
You just recently, under the DMA, went after three big U.S. tech companies, and to be honest, Commissioner, three's a crowd. I'm really curious to know which of these you are honing in on, and because a lot of people really seem to think it's Apple, where the EU has a lot of problems with.
Well, what's the point of the Digital Markets Act is to open the market, to make sure that, that more businesses can get to their customers so customers have more choice. So obviously, we are looking at getting out of self-preferencing so that you do not, if you, for instance, have a Google search, and you do not just get a Google product. And we're looking at how businesses can get a real relationship with their customers. So to get rid of the anti-staring that we see quite a lot, and people have choice if they want to stay in the Apple payment environment or they want to have a direct and sometimes cheaper relationship with their service provider.
Well, among those three, Apple, Google, and Meta, do you have a priority target?
Well, we have opened these five cases because we think these are very important. We may have more cases in the pipeline, so we have given retaining orders for what may be evidence once we're moving forward. These five cases, they are all priority. We think that they are absolutely key if our suspicions are confirmed, that we get compliance, because this is what opens the market, and that's the basic idea of the Digital Markets Act, for many more businesses to have a fair chance to get to their customers.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage.
But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Okay, time for Talking Tech. And first up, KKR is said to be reviewing options of a sale or an IPO for BMC Software, which could be worth as much as $15 billion, including debt. That's according to sources. While no final decisions have been made, KKR is favoring an IPO of BMC, which filed confidentially last year with the SEC. For a listing. Plus, French chip materials company Soitec is said to be considering building a factory in the United States, following in the footsteps of one of its biggest customers, TSMC, as it expands from Arizona to Texas with government incentives. The consideration would mean that Soitec would add to its global factory facilities alongside Singapore, Belgium, and France, and positions the company for growth outside of China. And Saudi Arabia and the UAE are racing for AI dominance, rushing to build out expensive data center infrastructure to help support the technology. Both countries lag behind Western Europe in terms of data center capacity, with hopes of closing that gap in a few years. In a recent report by PwC, it's estimated that AI will contribute nearly $96 billion to the UAE and $135 billion to Saudi Arabia's economy by 2030. Caroline.
That was a great Business Week piece. Meanwhile, let's just talk about employees over in an Apple store in Short Hills, New Jersey. They just petitioned to unionize. It's marking the first such effort that we've seen in about a year-long lull of news around this. Bloomberg's Mark Gurman just going to remind us of the context when it comes to Apple, because they're not the first store that's looking to unionize.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. The Apple unionization efforts really kicked into high gear right in the middle of the COVID pandemic. In 2022, you saw their retail store in the Towson area of Maryland petition to unionize. They successfully unionized. They're now recognized as a unionized Apple retail store. The Penn Station store at a mall in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, is a unionized store. So those two are the only two unionized stores. But there have been a few other stores that attempted, one in St. Louis, Missouri, one in Atlanta, Georgia. Those fell apart. One of those unions even chastised the union company and ended up siding with Apple. Now you have another store joining in, and that is the Short Hills Mall store in upscale area in New Jersey. And at this point, it's still early. They've petitioned. They have 104 employees that would be part of the union. There still needs to be a vote. They still need to get to the bargaining table with Apple. But this is the process. And so this was a major development, petitioning, publicly stating, hey, we are trying to unionize. So this is a big deal, the fifth store that we know of to attempt.
They are trying to unionize. This is a path trodden by Amazon. You know, Caroline and I have kind of been through a similar story arc with that company. But I guess the next question to ask, Mark, what is Apple's attitude towards unionization, the company's approach?
Well, the company is completely against unionization. They've been holding roundtables at the Short Hills, New Jersey store for months now, pushing back on the idea of that team unionizing. They don't want to have to change their perks, their benefits, their pay strategy. You know, Apple is a company that wants things to be consistent and completely under their control. Unionization upsets that finely tuned balance the company has enjoyed for as long as it has under Tim Cook and Steve Jobs before him. So certainly this is not something that Apple wants. I think they're fairly happy that out of the 270 and change retail stores in the U.S., only two have successfully unionized. And of those two, they haven't given them anything.
Bloomberg's chief correspondent, Mark Gurman, thank you. Well, Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. Ed Ludlow here in San Francisco.
And Caroline Hyde in New York. I've got to check on the markets for you, Ed, because right now, look, we're actually seeing NASDAQ and tech stocks outperform on a day where bond yields are still selling off on the end of the curve. So 10-year yields are seeing 4 basis points to the higher. We are still trying to debate the inflationary pressures. We have PPI today, CPI yesterday, still showing inflation is kind of going the wrong direction for the Federal Reserve. If you're banking on a cut come June, people starting to take those bets off the table. We're seeing Bitcoin under pressure just by 0.2%. We're at 69,665. We're basically kind of treading water ahead of earnings season as well. The banks kick it off tomorrow. Moving on to some individual movers. I mean, interesting on the upside, a lot of the key names are used to Nvidia, Apple, indeed, even Amazon at a new record high today after its shareholder letter. I want to shine a light on Atlassian. It's getting an upgrade from analysts, thinking that now is the time to be buying into this enterprise-focused software company. So up more than 3%. Tesla, though, once again languishing, pulling back. In fact, you noted that Rivian shares are falling as much as 7% to a record low. Some reports that Ford is cutting its EV prices. Elon Musk apparently looking at India. Maybe we'll get some updates on supply and indeed demand coming from that country. Adobe, though, one to watch. Interesting reporting coming out on basically how expensive it is sometimes to be training your large language models and text to video in particular, and where you're getting some of those videos from. We want to dig in on Adobe, just under pressure by about percentage point today, but looking like it is really trying to take on the likes of Sora, of course, OpenAI's product, when it comes to AI video generation. Apparently offering its network of photographers and artists to get this $120 to submit videos of people engaged in everyday actions, walking, expressing emotions, joy, anger, according to documents all seen by Bloomberg. Let's just get more with our own reporter, Brody Ford, who helped break this story. And it is notable that they're playing a bit of catch-up here with text to video. But where they don't have to play so much catch-up is where they train their data. You'd have thought, but maybe they have to pay a bit extra.
Yeah, it's a funny dynamic. So they have this giant repository of images they've been using to train their photos. They got like 300 million photos, not as big of a deal. When it comes to the video, they don't have quite as much of that in the stock library. So we see now that they're starting to procure data to be able to train on. And it's really funny kind of videos, right? It's like some of the sample videos is people smiling, people frowning, picking up weights, right? Training these AI models on how people really interact with the world.
I like that they think we're all really fit.
Yes, they think we're all very fit. Or they don't even have any videos of us doing it, so they know we're not, right? But yeah, so they really need these videos to help their model understand how the world works and so that they can, you know, not get smoked by OpenAI.
Mate. $2.62 per minute, or as high as $7.25 per minute based on your reporting, good reporting. If you're the CFO or COO of Adobe, and that's before you factor in compute costs, you're not going to be thrilled about the cost of training a model. Like, the economics here are actually newsworthy. This is a surprise.
So it's not quite as high as it may sound like, right? Because it's $120 for 100 short videos, right? I was trying to do the math of if I wanted to create this, it's going to take you a good 5-6 hours to make all these videos doing push-ups, then cooking, then smiling, then frowning. I mean, the actual amount they're paying ends up being pretty low. And you could say that, all right, I mean, they could scrape the open internet for free, but we know that there are issues there with tagging the videos correctly, getting the exact quality you need. So, I mean, these are things they might need to procure once, but they can continue to train on. So, yes, it is a material amount of money in the grand scheme. It's not like they're shelling out a ton to every creator, though.
I mean, all of this comes within the context of Sora and where it got its data, right?
Yeah, right. We all saw that viral clip of the OpenAI CTO saying, oh, we don't know where it was trained, but right, we all kind of know where it was trained, right? And I mean, that's been Adobe's whole marketing pitch, that we're going to try to do things the right way. We're going to only use sources that we have true access to.
You're not going to get done in the courts, basically. You're not going to get sued.
You're not. They literally say, if you get sued, we're going to be there with you. We'll see you in court. We'll back you up. Will that end up holding them back? Will that end up costing more than it needs to? It is yet to be seen, but that's at least their public message at this time.
Bloomberg's Brody Ford.
Thank you.
Always on top of it when it comes to Adobe. Thank you. Now, OpenAI CEO Sam Altman has been working to build a global coalition among government and industry leaders to support boosting the supply of chips, energy, and data center capacity that's needed to develop artificial intelligence technology. That's according to our sources, and Bloomberg's Shireen Ghaffari broke that story with me and joins me on set. This is kind of an evolution of our existing reporting, right? It started with this idea that Sam Altman was worried about the supply long term of AI accelerators or the GPUs that train models and later inference. It's bigger now. Just recap for our audience what you and I have learned.
Right. So we know now that Sam Altman has been in the UAE this week, meeting with government officials, with investors, and the pitch is to build some kind of global coalition that goes beyond just manufacturing chips, but actually into also things like energy production, which is a huge and growing resource for them that they're quite worried about securing.
What's interesting here is the players. We have some understanding that Sam met with UAE officials. G42 is a name that gets bandied around. But do we know who's in this coalition so far?
So we know the pitch is that it's worldwide. Sam is traveling to Washington, D.C. today, right, to meet with people on Capitol Hill, with national security leaders. So we know that, he's talking to U.S. leaders as well. But we also know that he's talking to, he has in the past talking to leaders of several Western countries and democracies. And so the pitch goes beyond just the Middle East for sure.
It's got to resonate with lawmakers. It's got to resonate with the supply chain more, Shirin. And look, we're seeing a lot of money being spent by the U.S. government trying to lure offshore chip makers, manufacturers, fabs ultimately coming from TSMC. There's much reporting on whether Samsung's going to be here as well, digging in deeper. How much is he talking to corporate America and corporations more broadly as well? Just because this doesn't happen overnight.
Right. I mean, I think this conversation is going to go beyond OpenAI to other industries. I don't think, you don't want the pitch to sort of just focus on one company, but rather on building out the capabilities for industry as a whole. So that's what I'm understanding the discussion to be at these times.
It's a brilliant reporting from both you and Ed, and we'll see what that conversation ends up looking like on Capitol Hill as well. I'm sure you're reporting on that too, Shirin Geoffrey. We thank you so much. Meanwhile, coming up, PitchBook out with its latest report into the health of the VC industry. We're going to be digging into PitchBook analyst Kyle Stanford. That's next. This is Bloomberg Technology.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Talk about private markets a little bit, fundraising therein. Beginning in 2024, met with some actual residual optimism, but that did not translate into meaningful growth in VC activity. That's all according to PitchBook's latest Venture Monitor report. It highlights that competition for capital remains fierce 2 years into a slowdown, and while stronger companies might still be able to compel investment, the same is not true for those that are kind of struggling. Carl Stanford, we're pleased to say, leads U.S. venture capital research over at PitchBook and joins us. And so it really feels like a tale of the haves and the have-nots. If you're an AI darling, you're able to reap it in. If you're not, and you're not managing to grow revenue and indeed profitability, count yourself out.
Yeah, but I mean, at some point, that's where this market should be, right? I mean, we're looking at high-risk investments, companies that should be growing fast, being able to, you know, get their product to market and eventually exit down the line. 55,000 companies are currently VC-backed in the U.S. market, you know, 120,000 or so globally. That's a huge number of companies that are still are fighting through similar trajectories, similar sectors, and fighting for that capital that's just not there anymore.
Okay. I am hearing and seeing things that the data doesn't show. For example, 24 hours ago, we had Toyota Ventures on the show. They are a single LP fund, granted, Toyota, but they raised even more money from that LP to invest in physical stuff. I'm hearing lots about funds that are being raised to invest in manufacturing, industrialization. Why is that not showing up in the data, Kyle?
Right. Well, I think first, if you start with Toyota Ventures or these corporate LPs, they have a much different return profile or ability to get these different returns than a traditional VC or traditional LP might be looking for. Right. There's a return on products or ability to integrate new products into their cars down the road. As a traditional LP, though, they're looking for that cash-on-cash return, and we have not seen that by any means. I mean, all the last quarter, the entire story was about Reddit and Astera Labs, which were you know, solid IPOs, but in total in the U.S., it was just $18.6 billion in exit value that was generated. And so if you're an LP without those returns and those distributions coming back to you, there's less incentive to put money back into the market now, or there's not an ability, right? They're looking for that capital to come back to recycle into new funds, new commitments, and make sure that they're in all these vintage years. But if that's not coming back, there's just no way for these traditional LPs to get or to put money back into the venture market right now.
And you say traditional LPs, and it has been fascinating to see almost the domination of corporate VC in the area of AI, certainly, compared to the venture capital arena right now. Who are a new guard of LPs that aren't corporate? Are we seeing venture capital companies managing to lure in different types of investors to secure their next funds?
When you think the investor, the LP base is going to always be wide-ranging, right? Pensions obviously are in there. You saw CalPERS re-up their commitment and increase their commitment to VC last quarter. I mean, corporates obviously are huge. You look at the Japanese corporations, and there's trillions of dollars on their balance sheet they're able to put to work in venture into new businesses. The large mega caps in the U.S. as well, huge amounts of cash to be able to put to work, and we've seen that in some of their AI investments over the past few years. I think where it really gets down to struggling for LPs is when you look at the smaller ones, right? The high net worth individuals that maybe are feeling still very wealthy, but not nearly as what they were in 2021. You look at foundations or endowments that are finding ways to put capital to work, but maybe are not as able to take that 10 years of illiquidity that VC is going to bring to their cash. So there is still a broad range, and investors, GPs are being very strategic with who they're going after and how they're positioning their strategy and VC fund to those LPs to make sure it works for them as well.
Kyle, it's been relatively exciting recently, in the IPO market. You know, Reddit as an example. Is there a relationship between upstream, downstream? So when LPs and the firms that they give money to see activity in the IPO market, do they regain faith that actually putting something into a 5 or 10 year horizon is a good idea?
I mean, I think relative excitement is a really good way to position Q1, right? I mean, those two IPOs were great, but there's 720 unicorns in the market right now, or private in the U.S., over 1,400 globally. Globally, there's a $4.8 trillion market cap on these unicorns. And so a couple of IPOs is great, but until those distributions actually get going back to LPs, again, it's going to be a slow fundraising market. It's going to be a slow deal-making market. We have, our fund distribution data is showing that distributions over the past four quarters have been, as low as they were in the global financial crisis. And so, again, there is definitely some positives that come out of a few companies going public, but there needs to be many more. And the M&A market, again, too, where a lot of these returns are also going to get generated, is non-existent. Many of the deals we had from an M&A perspective this quarter had no deal of value attached, right? So they're immaterial to the corporate growth. And so that's a very difficult spot when you look at returns down the road.
Hey, Carl, let's tap into your relative excitement. What are you relatively excited about thematically, subsector-wise?
Sure. Subsector-wise, I mean, obviously AI is going to be the major area going forward. I think we've seen a lot of unique companies and unique business models getting started. I think it's interesting dynamic, too, with the incumbents in Microsoft and AI, Microsoft and Google and Amazon being so heavy into it. I think it's going to be very quick what we were talking about, the bifurcation and have and have nots. I think there's going to be a lot of money made in AI and there's going to be a lot of money lost. And I think it's going to be relatively quick over the next few years because of the incumbents and how they're playing in the market. Tech in general, I think, is still really strong. Even though it's a slow market, like Caroline said, strong companies are getting funded. There's money out there for these companies. And so tech is going to continue pushing forward what we've seen. But it's going to be a difficult market, I think, for every sector down the road.
Carl Stanford, lead U.S. venture capital research analyst at PitchBook. Thank you very much.
More protection for teens on Instagram is coming. Now, the social platform run, of course, by Meta is turning to AI to blur out nude images sent via direct message. Now, Instagram announced in a blog post today that the update aims to protect users from unwanted photos as well as from potential sextortion scammers. This comes, of course, as U.S. politicians have been continuing to accuse the platform of damage to youth mental health. Ed.
Let's stay with Instagram. It's recently changed its policies for political content, and it has caused a stir from some users. The move, which is coming during an election year, has prompted some pushback, with some, like Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn, even accusing the company of censorship. You're looking at the post that she made on X. Let's break it all down with Elle Rochford, senior data and policy specialist with the Crime and Justice Institute, as well as Jess Natale, creator of the So Informed Instagram page. Jess, let's start with you. You are a user, a well-followed user of Instagram. The policy and its rationale are clear. What is your response to it?
I mean, I think it's quite alarming and quite transparent, the timing in which this is being rolled out. As small things like preparing people for the election, giving them the educational tools, all the way to a genocide being documented on their platform, I think it's taking away the authority for people to consume what they want to be consuming, which is important information. It's news.
I'm interested in the academic perspective here, Elle, because your PhD is in sociology over at Purdue. You're focused on reproductive justice, on racial justice movements in particular. And I'm wondering if when ultimately Instagram is saying, we are not trying to clamp down on what you have actively decided you want to watch, those that you follow, but it's more people that you don't follow sort of suddenly getting into your reels, into your streams more broadly, how much do you think that this does limit, you know, ultimately people not wanting to be bombarded with things that they don't want to be seeing? Or indeed, does it cut off an ability to see outside your own bubble right now?
Sure. I think that's a great question. Opting in to seeing political content is a little bit tricky because a lot of users weren't aware this feature was being rolled out at all. So they weren't aware that this rollout would impact what they were seeing or not seeing. But it seems a bit odd, the selection criteria. So social topics are being filtered out, but how is that being defined? Social media offers essential infrastructure, informational infrastructure to users. And so a lot of young people are getting their news from social media, and this will impact what they're seeing and what they're not seeing, and they may not even be aware that there are things being filtered from their viewing.
So before we dig in with you, Elle, a little bit more about where the lines are drawn and where are blurry as to what is seen as political content, I just want to go to you, Jess, because your numbers, just give us a breakdown. People who opt in to see your content because they want to be politically informed by you, are they seeing less of your content on the back of this? You still getting the amount of video engagement, still getting the amount of people who want to come and build up your profile ultimately?
There is absolutely a dramatic decrease in the people I'm reaching and the people who are engaging, which, you know, those go hand in hand. Prior to this being rolled out, it was also, there was censorship in place before this, and I want to make that clear. Instagram was censoring content well before this new rollout. But this has caused a dramatic decrease. I have 3.1 million followers. So 3.1 million people who have opted in to see what I'm posting. And I have been reaching somewhere between 6 and 8% of my own followers since this went into place.
Okay, Elle, I'm an Instagram user, Caroline's Instagram user. There is the policy side, and then there's just the technology, the platform. And I think many people would say Instagram is not a place you go for news or politics. Many would just say it's for entertainment value. It is to share what you're interested in from a passion point of view. That is an experience I think many people have. What does your research tell you about the majority of use case for why people go to Instagram and the type of content they're trying to get?
Absolutely. So I think there's also many people who would say they don't go to Instagram to see food content, that they're sick of seeing food blogs and recipes, right? So for every user who doesn't want to see political content, there are users who are seeking out political content and news content on Instagram. The perception that Instagram is not a political platform is just that. It's a perception. There are plenty of users who use Instagram for to follow journalists, to follow news outlets, to follow political organizations. And political organizations are very active on the platform. So this is going to harm those organizations in all directions across the political spectrum. And I think it's a bit short-sighted to say that Instagram isn't a political platform and that that's not what users want to see. We have plenty of evidence that activists are online and that Instagram's being used for political organization and for entertainment purposes. A lot of political content is entertaining for people, although that might not be their primary source of entertainment.
And often their passion. We thank you for bringing both of your passions today, Elle Rochford, of course, and Jess Natale. We wish we had longer with both of you. This is Bloomberg Technology.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.